This program has been brought to you by Cider Week New York City, happening November 6th through 15th, 2015. For more information, check out ciderweeknyc.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to episode 239 of Cutting the Curd, a podcast all about cheese, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today's episode is a continuation of a discussion from an episode that broadcast on our radio network about a year ago. That was episode 194. It was called What's in a Cheese Name. In that episode, I spoke with Rachel Perez and David Grotenstein about name-protected cheeses of Europe. For today's episode, I'm talking with Thalassa Skinner of Culture Magazine and Deborah Dickerson of Tamales Bay Foods about cheese names here in the U.S. They're both on the line. How are you doing, gals?
Hey, Greg.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure.
So I was driving up the road or being driven up the road in towards Keene, New Hampshire with my family, and I went past this sort of unmarked building that had this huge old sign in front of it, and the sign was like one of those big metal signs with sort of like neon like lights around it, and it was pointing towards the building, and it just said stuff and things, and I was like, wow, you know, I need to go in there. I have no idea what's in there. There's no windows in the building, but I need to know what stuff and things are, you know? And I was like, that's a great name. And it just made me start thinking. I was away from cheese for a minute, and it made me start thinking about cheese names. And not cheese names so much in terms of protecting them and you know, using the PDO method of name protection, but just names in general. It started me thinking about names of everything, but mostly names of cheese, because I have a lot of those rattling around my head all the time, and I'm sure both of you do too. So with that in mind, I wanted to ask you both, and maybe you could start, Deborah. What do you think makes an effective cheese name for American producers?
First of all, hi, Lassa. It's nice to share Greg with you.
Ditto.
And, you know, I thought that this was going to be a really easy question, but when I started thinking about it, it got a little bit complex. And I think the first thing is that we don't have a tradition, right, like the protected names of Europe. We don't have any, so we have all kinds of crazy names out there. And I was starting to think about it, and I think my bottom line is it only matters in the very beginning. Right? Once you taste that cheese, if that cheese knocks your socks off, you'll never forget that name, no matter what it is. It's all of those steps in between, right? So that's the big thing for me. And the second thing is, where is it going to be sold, right? Because there's some names we find in the artisan cheeses that we sell to restaurants, they don't want to say that on the menu because they
right.
don't think it's friendly with food. Right? But if you're in a retail shop, if it's number one pronounceable, number two, if it portrays some kind of an attitude, right, about the cheese, and if it's memorable, or maybe it tells something about what the cheese is going to taste like or what kind of cheese it is. But at the end of the day, if the cheese is great, it's not an issue. That's what I think.
That's pretty good. Thalassa, what about you? What do you think?
I think that's really well said, Deborah. And as always, you're always well spoken. And I feel that American cheese makers do tend to still kind of like a lot of the PDO cheeses still do tend towards using names that are locations or things that are iconic for their region, so there really is still a tie to the place, and that does matter with the cheese as well in terms of the cheese maker. So that's one thing, but I'd also say that a catchy name to me that isn't too trite, that is catchy, something like fat bottom girl. It doesn't necessarily say what the cheese is, but it kind of sticks in your mind, and it makes you smile, and then it stays in your mind. And we're very good at marketing in America.
We are.
So there's something to that. But I'd say, first of all, just as Deborah, I completely agree with you. If the cheese is great and you want it again, you're going to remember the name of it. So it all comes back to, is it a great cheese, and what, you know, what the individual preference is on that.
So, see, the name, so I would actually agree with all of that to a certain extent. I'm stubborn, so sometimes if I don't like the name, even if the cheese tastes really good, and people say, what's the name of that cheese? I sort of begrudgingly, like, sit it out. I'm like, yeah, it's, you know? and then, you know, but that's me because I'm a curmudgeon. I agree. it's just how I am. Memorable and pronounceable are fantastic for American cheeses. That's a lot easier, I feel like. You know, names of European cheeses just sound better, and most of the time they're very utilitarian in nature. You know, people say that to me all the time at Eataly, I want Pecorino Toscano, and I'm like, yes, that sounds great. It just means sheep from Italy, you know, and that's great. But I also agree that things that are catchy but not trite. I feel like as Americans, we are very good marketers, but we are also very trite, you know, in in a lot of ways. The name Fat Bottom Girl is fantastic, but that's just a great – that's also the name – of a song, correct?
Right. So, yeah, Queen song.
Right. So, I mean, that's like, that's a great sort of neo, you know, marketing right there. You know, they're taking something that's recognizable and applicable to their product, you know, because everybody loves that song, you know, and the cheese also happens to be very good.
Targeting their market. Very clever.
You're right.
You know?
Exactly.
I feel like, you know, I think, Deborah, what you said is really, really, it's really important and true, is that we don't have that tradition, you know? We do, but it's not the same, it's not steeped in the same principles as the European tradition, I feel.
Well, and I feel like, not to get too far into this.
Why wouldn't you?
Sorry, go ahead.
I said, why wouldn't you want to get too far into this?
Well, no, I mean, what I was about to say is that I don't want to get too far into the PDO idea,
right.
But the fact of the matter is, as a former cheesemonger and as the cheese people, we have to describe something as something. So we still go back to the place of origin of many, many of the traditional cheeses, or the cheeses that a lot of the recipes come from. And what we, when we're talking about grappling with a new name, and the fact is, it is a new cheese, but it's still based on an older tradition coming from, often from Europe. So, you know, we do kind of have to have some reference to something, and I feel like a name should express a location or something that is of the new cheesemaker, of the cheesemaker here in America, but also with a nod, if possible, to its heritage, its origin, originally. And I like the idea of, at least when I think of cheeses, trying to have people not just think about the name, but what is it? Is it a cow's milk? Is it a goat's milk? Is it a sheep's milk? Is it a firm cheese? Is it a soft cheese? More of that, and then getting to the point where they start to remember the actual name of the cheese. So it's kind of everything's kind of a domino effect in how you learn about this.
Can I jump in here?
I would like
because
that.
There's an example, Lasse, that came to mind for me as you were speaking, and I think that, you know, in terms of identifying cow, goat, sheep, and soft and hard and rind and all that stuff, I absolutely agree. But I am a big believer that if you steer the customer down a path towards a European traditional, you set them up to love it or hate it. So there's an example of Springbrook Farm, who makes an amazing cheese called Redding, which is, you know, great in many ways. It's a beautiful cheese. It's farmstead. It's accessible flavor profile. And when they originally brought it out, and perhaps even still, they called it Redding Raclette. Mm-hmm. We were delighted to have the opportunity to sell it. And I threw myself at their feet and said, please don't make me call it Redding Raclette. Let me just call it Redding. Because I feel real strongly that the raclette is you know, pretty clearly defined to a good segment of the population. And I didn't want Redding to lose because it was different. And it could be good different or it could be bad different, but I felt like that close association set us up for the potential to lose, and I didn't want to lose. So we just call it
completely agree with you on that. I guess I didn't mean in the name itself. I meant in the follow-up of what it is. Because it is, it will be wonderful when we get to the point where we really have our own names and our own actual areas where people are helping produce a similar style of cheese, because that works best there. But we're a far cry from that at the moment. So catchy names, coming back to it, I think is really, really important. Something like a Humboldt Fog, which both has a sense of place, but then also has a visual image, you know, that it conjures up. And then it literally is something that you think about, the fog in Humboldt County.
Right.
So,
and that's an aesthetic of the cheese, too. That little ash line through the center is supposed to be the horizon over Marin County, right?
Yep.
Now, I wanted to bring it back just a second to what you were saying, Deborah, about Redding. See, now, at Eataly, I don't sell French cheeses, or at least I don't advertise that I sell French cheeses. Now, I call Redding Raclette, and it works, you know, because people ask me for Raclette all of the time, you know. Mm-hmm. It works in, as soon as people taste it and realize how wonderful it is, because I get people from Europe and they want raclette, and I say, I have a raclette, it's from Vermont. And, you know, they turn their noses up a lot and they're like, you know, but then I shove some of it into their face and then they usually buy large amounts of it, you know. And I get what you're saying. You know, you didn't want to have to call it that because you put it up against other cheeses that are called raclette. That's why you wanted to call it something different, right?
Well, we don't sell raclette either, right? But my method is exactly the same as yours. Get it in their mouth
right,
as quickly as possible and let them. And the difference is I don't give them the benchmark comparison. I let them do it themselves. And, you know, none of us say, oh, I don't have that, right? We all go, here, try this,
right?
And let them go.
There's an alternative.
Exactly. Let them go from there. So, yeah, I don't know what that is. It could be from my experience with Montgomery's cheddar.
Sure.
You know, and the Neal Jard dairy names, which are all very much in terms of clearly identifying the type and then honoring the producer. You know, and that is their method. Mm-hmm.
The territorials.
They use.
Right.
Exactly. But to put, you know, the Kirkham name on it, or to Kirkham's Lancashire, or to put Montgomery's cheddar on it, and for me that was it is a true English cheddar, and yet there are, you know, four producers of traditional English cheddar, and the Montgomery's cheddar is different than the Keene's cheddar, and so the nuances of those differences are critical, so that it is both that territorial name cheddar and Montgomery's name is key for people understanding the cheese.
Sure, it's like
so,
a surname.
Anyway, maybe I was too influenced by those strict territorial.
But those are strong names.
I would also jump in and say that I think it's knowing your audience on that, and mm-hmm. I mean, Greg, just taking those two examples based on the, you know, the kind of people that are the Europeans that are coming into Eataly versus what will probably, I mean, there's a lot of different people coming into the Ferry Plaza building, and especially, you know, there versus Point Reyes, they're markedly different. So it's the skill of the actual person behind the counter who is talking about things and how you approach that.
Sure.
You're going to have two different populations.
But it's like this. It's like a golf course. You have the pro tees, you have the everybody tees, and you got the senior tees. You know, which tee you play from, you know, kind of helps out your score. So if you handicap somebody with a real crappy name, you're going to put another 20 yards on the course for them, and the chances of them them getting the ball in the hole, which is somebody's mouth, is a little bit less, in my opinion. You know, that's why I like strong names. And I like there are, you know, there are a lot of different examples of cheese names that work. And I was hoping we could maybe just dial it back a second, because we could all talk a long time about this because we have lots of names in our head. But I've got a list of different types of cheese names, and I just wanted to go through a couple of them and talk about how effective they are at selling cheese and describing the flavor or philosophy behind the cheeses. So, you know, we have cheeses named after where they're made in the U.S., and then cheeses named after the cheese or place in Europe that inspired them. Which one do you guys think is more effective? And Lasse, I'll start with you.
Are you talking about more effective for the American market?
Yes. In our market to sell cheese.
I think that if you have, I think in the U.S. market, it's more effective. If you're taking the average person, if you say a Vermont cheddar, I think that you'll have a lot of people go for that.
Why do you think that is?
Is that what you mean?
It is what I mean. But why do you think that is?
Because I think we're proud. And I think that it identifies if it's an American cheese that is already known in that area, like a New York State cheddar versus a Vermont cheddar, that you're going to have people purchasing it for that. If it says, you know, Montgomery cheddar, it's still it's a much smaller chunk of the population that knows what that means.
Right on. Deborah, do you agree with that?
I do, although I think I do agree. And I also, when I was looking back, there's a lot of cheesemakers, Lasse, as you referred to in the beginning, who pulled geographic names for their sense of place, right? And these are places I never in God's name have ever heard of. You know, maybe they're increasing tourism in their area, but there's that lovely cheesemaker. His company is called Volto, and he has a cheese called Oliot. Am I pronouncing that right?
Sure. That's as well as I pronounce it.
So it's like, what the heck is that, right? And I thought, well, maybe it's an Indian name. But indeed, it's about a river, right?
Yeah, it's named after a creek.
It's about a creek. And I just thought that was fascinating. And that's where he is. And that's his geography. I think it's somewhere in Delaware or something like that.
Yeah, I think, and I completely agree with that, too. I feel like I was talking in a big sense versus a small, like almost all the Jasper Hill cheeses are named after a person or a place. And as is Mount Tam and da da da.
And then you have a collection, right? So you know, right? You know that any, not to speak of cowgirl cheeses specifically, but...
Why would you do that?
But thank you. We're all about the geography in our area, right? Mount Tamalpais, which is Mount Tam, and the, you know, the Pierce Point, and the Red Hawk, which is the bird, and we are really the sense of place. And so our collection is about that, right? And like Jasper Hill with the Windermere, right? And the people, the ladies in blue. It's about their geography and their history. So then it becomes familiar, and then it creates that that sense of place and that sense of history, which I think is great. If you look at the other thing that I wanted to, just because I think this is one of the most adorable labels out there, you think of Cypress Grove, right? And they've done such a good job, and they have continued to move forward with their labeling and their branding, right? So they had their Fresh Chev, and then they had Psychedelic with the D-I-L-L, right? And the
Purple
Fresh Chev with Dill, right? And then they have the Midnight Moon, right? And I thought, oh, that's a picture of a moon over cypress trees. But when I pulled up, it's this woman from the 20s. She's like a flapper, and she's standing
with
in
a hat
in a forest somewhere. But then you look at Lamb Chopper. Is that not the best label, right, of a lamb on the back of a motorcycle?
On the big Harley?
I don't really kind of care what the cheese tastes like, though it happens to be delicious. The label is adorable.
Yeah, it totally is. I agree. And that's that actually brings me to my next category of cheese name. What do you guys think? And Deborah, I'll go first to you on this one. Cheese names that are cute or memorable, where do you stand on that? You know, as opposed to like those solid English territorial names, or those names of the cheese names that are specifically referring to a place or, you know, or a region. You like the cute names?
I think that this goes back to Lasse's point of know your audience, right? So the fat bottom girl is one. This is the one that a restaurant who is a huge supporter of it won't call it that. They won't. They
Why
won't
not?
Call it that. The servers won't call it that.
It's what do they very, call it?
It's a fancy restaurant, very expensive, incredible food, you know, top chef, won't call it that. They just won't do it. She has other names like Moolicious, right, which is a blue cheese, which is phenomenal. Adorable names, absolutely adorable. Some people love it. Some people think it cheapens the brand. I myself think it shows the attitude of the cheesemaker, and her byline is, you know, we make great cheese and don't take ourselves too seriously, and it shows. And again, as long as that cheese is great, it's great. I think the ubiquitous ones, the ones that are like, you know,
that's a great word, ubiquitous.
But it's names like that which you don't quite know what to do with it, like Moon Over the Prairie.
Right, that's a little much. But I would buy a cheese named Ubiquitous Blue if that were out there.
Ooh,
I would buy it.
Will take you up.
Sounds
on that
awesome.
One.
Sounds awesome. You know, and
again, I think you're picking your audience on that one.
Yeah, exactly. Right,
but
a
that's
lot of
the
people
thing.
Wouldn't know how to pronounce that, but I'm just putting it out there.
You have this other. So I have one more question before we go to break. But it is about your audience. See, like, so I look at cheese names. So there's a great farm in Vermont, and I've interviewed the cheesemakers on the show before, and it's the Twig Farm. And his names are so simple. It's like square cheese. Yeah, twig round, goat tall.
Fuzzy
wheel. That's pretty awesome. I love that.
Yeah.
There's like
but
a simple elegance
in that.
He can
do that because he's not mixing any other milks. And, you know, and I love that, too. I think it's great. I was thinking about that as we were going to have this conversation. I thought, well, what if everybody just said, you know,
square cheese. What's the name of your cheese? Round cheese.
Yeah. Which is how I like to, you know, talk about cheese. Well, what do you like? Do you like it when it has a bloomy rind and you like a soft goat? But how do you identify different makers beyond that and which of their cheeses? So the names are absolutely crucial. And, you know, I mean, going back to this idea of cute names, I think there is a place for them. I personally, some I really like Fat Bottom Girl, and I also like Barely Buzzed. Mm-hmm. I think it says something about it. But I would be more inclined to want to see less trite and more what is it. I like cheeses that actually tell the names that tell you something about the cheese.
I agree. And my last question, and I'm going to throw this out to you, Deborah, and then Lasse, I want your opinion too. So how do you think U.S. cheese names are perceived on the international market?
Ooh, good question. I don't think a lot of American cheeses are exported. So the ones that are, I think there's very few artisanal ones that are exported. So I don't think that...
Not enough information? Small sample size?
Exactly.
Yeah,
let me reverse
that,
though.
There's so few out there.
But what do you think European cheesemongers, makers, and customers think of cheeses when they come to America to buy U.S. cheese? Because I know that people from Europe do that. They do it in my store all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think Europeans think of our
names? They're looking for it. I know that for a fact, having just been over in, you know, in Italy and in Bra, where there was a whole cheese... A whole group from America, and they're excited, and they see the momentum, and you know they want to try them. They're much less worried about the name of the cheese than they are in tasting it, and if they like it, they buy it because Europeans really love to eat cheese.
Right. Well, they better be worried.
I also think that some of those quirky little, you know, quirky little names, cute little names, the meaning might be lost on them, right? It might be a literal translation, which might be a little bit confusing, but nonetheless, in the mouth, it might make the statement.
Well, they need to pay attention because for the purpose of this show, they need to care, all right?
Exactly. They do.
So we're going to take a little bit of a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about something else for a minute. Hang on.
Cider Week helps to bring profitability to local orchards while reviving heirloom apple varieties by cultivating awareness of craft cider. Cider Week connects cider makers from New York State and select pioneering guest cideries outside the state to buyers from top restaurants, bars, and retail shops across New York City. Those culinary tastemakers, in turn, help increase consumer awareness of cider's pleasures by hosting public events, tastings, dinners, classes, and pairings that build appreciation and demand for regional ciders.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I have Deborah Dickerson and Lasse Skinner on the line, and we've been talking about cheese names in the U.S., which is super fun, and I love it. But I want to switch gears for a minute, and I want to quickly touch base on the latest chapter in the battle for raw milk cheese here in the U.S. Today is the November 2nd deadline for submissions in response to the FDA's request for information regarding safe production of cheese from unpasteurized milk. For those of you who listen weekly, we did a couple of public service announcements in our prior episode about filling out the Cheese Coalition survey about consumer attitudes towards raw milk cheese. And that also falls under this request for info from the FDA. So, Deborah, I was wondering if you could maybe talk to our listeners a bit about what this request for info was all about, and why is the FDA gathering data on raw milk cheese, and what do you think the result will be?
Boy, I am not sure that I can answer that question in its entirety. I am not a cheesemaker. I am certainly an advocate of well-produced raw milk cheese. I know that the American Cheese Society over 2014-2015 has worked very hard to establish a relationship with the FDA. Previously, I believe, they have focused their attention on large commodity production and haven't taken into consideration the differences in scale of production and the differences in care in production between the two, the differences necessary to do a farmstead raw milk artisan cheese of low production capacity versus a large production facility which is gathering milk from many miles around. And the ACS was able to come to the table and to represent its membership as a viable source of information, not only of consumers but producers, and also an incredibly large segment of the rural economy that happens with small cheesemaking facilities within their states and counties. So I think that that's part of it. The thing that they asked for comments, I think, is fantastic because we in the artisan cheese world are highly opinionated and incredibly passionate about this area and being able to give people a choice to produce raw milk cheese. And the Cheese of Choice Coalition, which is an organization which I think your listeners are aware of, and if they're not, please ask them to check it out online, has been an advocate for raw milk cheese making. I do believe that the standards by which cheesemakers are judged are a bit inconsistent, so my hope is that they're looking to harmonize the regulations by which they evaluate cheesemakers. I also think that there's a lot of work being done to put into place good manufacturing practices and HACCP programs and milk testing at the source. So whether or not you're making with pasteurized milk or with raw milk, you are checking your raw ingredients. And it's really about good practices and helping teach people how to be better versus punitive actions moving backwards. That's my hope. I am open to any comments anybody has on this.
What do you think, Lasse?
Wow.
It's a big one.
Well, number one, I think it's great that the American Cheese Society has stepped forward, which is really a non-denominational for most people who are in the cheese industry. They are trying very hard to educate and educate both on the consumer side as well as the maker side and in every way, shape, and form, but also make this relationship with the FDA. So, and the FDA has also said, we want to learn. So I think this, in every way, this is really good. And I think the underlying thing, which I often gets lost in this, is though nobody's nobody's trying to be evil here. It's ignorance on either side. Everybody wants to do the right thing, and nobody wants to either hurt someone with a product that's not good, nor do they want to stop things from happening. So education is paramount. But I think that these things take time, and there is, I think, the underlying, again, to underscore this, that ignorance really is the thing that it comes down to, not knowing the science, not understanding how cheese is made and what's really happening, and as Deborah says, to look at the practices that people have and make it a supportive environment rather than a negative, oh, you're doing something, it's too much and you need to stop kind of environment. I think that what I would like to hear from this, especially coming from this whole, and what I read from the ACS's response to this, was that this educational side of it and throwing this question out so everybody, whether you be a cheesemaker or a consumer or anything, can actually respond to this with right. some education behind it will actually help the FDA understand where the public stands on this. And this is one of those times that you really have to to voice your opinion.
Right.
So it's perhaps where the danger lies. And I think that that's where I'm, I can always jump into the question, but it makes me wonder, why is raw milk, why is that targeted as a source of foodborne illness out of all of the things that come across the USDA website for recalls? Right, that's always sort of what I wonder. And though it is one thing of many, and all things should be evaluated, I'm always curious about that.
Me too, because the foodborne illness the foodborne illnesses in cheese is like a very, very, very small part of the whole pie of the foodborne illnesses that get reported to the Board of Health or anywhere. It's like less than 1% annually of foodborne illness. You know what I mean? Like it's not up there. I mean, bad meat, bad seafood, that's where you're going to die. You're going to eat some bad chicken.
You're going down.
Sure. You're going down hard.
I agree with you. I think it was four incidents between 1998 and 2011 was what came through to CDC. But the other thing is, there's an economical component to the question.
Well, there always is.
And so, perhaps it is in everybody's best interest, because dairy is such a huge part of the American economy, it's in everybody's interest to make sure that there are no outbreaks of any kind, pasteurized or raw,
right?
Because there are so many jobs and so many people's livelihood that depends on it.
See, and now that's a nice way to look at it. And I always swing to the other side and to say that it encourages larger concerns, food concerns, to be more profitable. By giving people less options, to eat. I mean, you have people out there who are teaching food safety. At a place that I just was, we're encouraging people not to eat sprouts from a farm because they could possibly be carrying some sort of disease. And I was like, what do you want from a farm? Do you want this stuff to grow on a tree already in the box? You know what I mean? Like, it's just... I go the other way. I mean, your way is probably the better way to go, but I just wonder, because there's so much money involved. But that's just me. Maybe I shouldn't say those sort of things.
I do agree, actually, Greg, and I think there's parts of everything that both Deborah and I would thumbs up on. But I do think that coming back to ignorance is something. I mean, if you don't understand something, and I'm not going to point the finger at the FDA, but I know there were times when there was talks happening in front of us where it was very clear that this was an area they really just didn't know a lot about, which is why I think it's really good that they're asking the questions that they're asking.
I agree with that, 100%.
I feel like cheese, as much as we like to think that people really understand cheese and cheese making, even at the highest levels, they don't. And so rather than learn about it, it's easier just to say, look,
slap some legislation on it.
Let's not. And so I think one of the things that impresses me a lot, and I think this is my big thing as a food lover in general, is that flavor is so important. And if you look, if we could, the American population and everybody could band together more with all cheese-making areas, especially ones that are looking at flavor components and the science behind that, they would understand why we are so incredibly keen on keeping raw milk cheeses in our life.
Absolutely.
And case in point on that is Comté. Gruyere is doing the same, but they have an entire school and laboratories built on studying flavor and the things that come in through the grass, through the soil, to show through the milk in the cheese. So if you love food and you love flavor, it's really important that we think about having unpasteurized, safe cheese.
And, amen to that.
And to look at the percentages of people that actually, over the globe, have ever been hurt in any way.
I absolutely agree with you, and I just want to add in here that, you know, raw milk in itself is not dangerous, right? The microbiology of milk, whether it's raw or pasteurized, is the sum of all the practices on the farm and the production, and that's where
right.
we need to look for all things, right? It's not
right.
the milk. It's how it's handled and the health of the cows and the skill of the cheesemaker and the maintenance of the equipment, you know, the entire thing. It's the entire thing, which is
right.
why cheesemakers absolutely have to be, and I think, you know, the responsibility is appropriately placed to be able to document their manufacturing practices and their HACCP plan and, you know, how they at every step ensure the public safety.
Yeah, you got to show your work every second of the way now. That's just the way it is.
And I don't think that's a bad thing.
No, it isn't. I
can appreciate that it's labor and time and cost, but that lies to us as the sellers and the consumers to educate, you know, that, you know, it can't be cheap. It just can't be.
The world in general needs right. transparency at this point. And I'm going through this in my job right now. You know, as you grow,
yeah.
as we grow, as our industry grows, transparency is key. It's not just us saying, hey, we got this. No, it's totally cool. Raw milk
yeah.
cheese is great. People need to see, you need to show the work. And I've been getting in trouble for not showing my work for about 36 years of my life. So,
why am I not surprised?
I get that. I wanted to say, you know, as a final public service announcement, the American Cheese Society submitted its official response to the FDA last week. That's what we're talking about, the link of which you can find on our show page at heritageradionetwork.org. Jesus. The ACS is encouraging all members to submit comments to the FDA as well, even if your comment simply states that as an ACS member, you support ACS's response. Now, I'm going to have to go quick and visit my parole officer. You know, I only get let out to do these shows once a week. But I just wanted to say, you know, in summary, that it was great to talk about cheese names and what makes a good name and just a discussion of that in general. And it's always nice to talk about, you know, important things like ACS and FDA and raw milk. So I wanted to thank you, Deborah and Thalassa, for coming on, and everybody for listening. We'll be back next week with more Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Eat good cheese.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.